Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Austin East Ciders. For more information, visit their website at austineastciders.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to
Foment About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And we're your co-hosts on this fermentable journey weekly here on Heritage Radio Network and archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and
HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Yeah, right, on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Thank God.
Right there on our home station's
coughing,
website.
Disrupted the flow of our weekly thing, threw me off.
Yeah.
But are you okay?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Well, welcome back.
I might be clearing my throat. I was wolfing down some sushi right before we went on the air because I'm starving, and I choked on some rice. Whew. Anyway.
Fantastic. We are very excited to be back. We were in Atlanta over the weekend. Mary's grandmother turned 100 years old.
What?
That's insane. Talk about fermentation. What kind of microbiome does she have? Anyway,
okay. Obviously a good one.
But your mother threw a hell of a party too. Shout out to Sue Izette for getting everybody together, and really it was incredible to celebrate a centurion.
Centenarian.
There we go. Centurion. I think that's Star Trek.
Doctor Who.
Okay.
Who.
There you go. Thank you. Yeah. Mary, she's looking at me. So
no, I'm going to tell. Well, I have. I'll give a shout out because we actually drank a lot of good beer. We did not. It was very house-centric, so we didn't actually visit any breweries or bars. But Chris and I took an early flight down there on Friday morning. We hit the ground just before 9 a.m., and our first stop was Green's Beverage on Ponce de Leon, which I highly recommend. I've been there several times before, but I was really impressed with their selection. Once again, I'm super impressed by the amount of breweries in Atlanta that are doing, and that area that are doing cans. So
yeah,
we picked
big can
up,
game.
Yeah, we picked up 8 six-packs.
Yeah. Creature Comforts.
Yeah. Blue Tarp. Three Taverns.
Mm-hmm.
We picked up a couple of Wicked Weeds as well, since we don't see those up here in New York City. So we had, and Orpheus was the other.
Orpheus.
The other one.
Some bottles of Monday Night.
Yes. So anyway, we had a lot of good beer. So shout out to all those breweries. We were very impressed, and we shared them with all my aunts and uncles and cousins and everyone.
That's right. Too bad they can't be here for all these fun things coming up. Here in New York City, the most notable events of the month to come, we're very excited about all of them. First up is this weekend, Poor Standards Homebrew Club presents Poor Mania 3 at Flagship Brewery on Staten Island. That's this Saturday with the Homebrewsicians playing some music. So we play a bunch of really silly songs, songs you know but with words you've never heard before, all referencing making beer. We have a lot of fun. It's a $30 donation. It helps support the club and aid in the club's annual Brew for Autism fundraiser, which they hold every year in January. But also 25% of the proceeds from this event go to the Staten Island Animal Rescue Organization. And you can go to poorstandards.com, click the Poor Mania page to find out more information on that. Then, on October 13th, me and Kelly Taylor are kind of in between having a brewery house right now, and we've been so busy that we haven't actually been able to visit a lot of the local breweries and give it the attention they deserve with any sort of regularity. So we've organized a trolley tour for anybody who wants to join us. We're getting an old-school New York trolley that has kind of been just no longer on any rails, but we're going to four different breweries. We're going to start at Folk's Beer, go to Strong Rope, Kings County Brewers Collective, and Interborough Spirits and Ales, and take people around. That is October 13th. More information on that has not actually been posted anywhere except the Eventbrite page. So I guess if you...
So you should stalk Who's Me on Facebook.
Stalk me on Facebook and you'll find a link to it. Or Kelso Beer on Facebook as well.
Or we'll put it on our... on Ferment Battle.
Yes, absolutely.
Facebook page.
Absolutely. It's going to be really fun, really cool. We're probably going to do more of these.
Probably going to sell out, too.
Yeah, there's only room on the trolley for 34 people, and I put it up today, and we're 15 people in on that. That's just in a day, I think, so... but we're definitely going to probably do more of this until both Kelly and I get too busy with our own breweries once again, once we're back up and running.
Yeah, just wait till de Blasio puts in that between Kings County and Queens County trolley. Then can have it on there.
Yes. Fantastic. But then also October 15th, just a couple days after that, Beer for Beasts at the Bell House. We talked about it last week. But each year, Six Point teams up with collaborators, among them Lil Ol' Me with Fifth Hammer Brewing Company, the brewery to be, to help create dozens of unique brews served at Beer for Beasts. These small batch one-time offerings are formulated exclusively for the event. 100% of the net proceeds from the event go to the Humane Society of New York. Go to beerforbeasts.com for info and tickets. That very same day, in the afternoon at the Well, the Bruminaries present Versus. Bruminaries are a local homebrew club, and they're putting together the best versions of beers, of international beers, in a competition of styles that they've brewed. So they're just competing for bragging rights and perhaps even settle long-standing feuds. You can go to bruminaries.com, find out more information about that, and get tickets for the afternoon at the Well. Did I say the Well? Speaking of the Well, October 22nd, New York City's Brewer Guild. And do you like...
I guess, so what's going on at the Well?
Oh, Blocktoberfest, the New York City Brewers Guild. That's not the New York City Home Brewers Guild, it's the New York City Brewers Guild. We are the collective of the New York City based brewers, pro brewers, and we have our annual fundraiser. This is the third year in a row for this. It'll be at the Well in the afternoon from 12:30 to 5:30. It's just all New York City breweries. It goes to fund our nonprofit organization that also runs New York City Beer Week, which is going to start on February 24th, 2017 this year. So this is our annual fundraiser. It's $10 to get in, and then it's basically a pay-as-you-go. And if you buy more tickets all at once, you can get discounts on what those pours are, and they're 12-ounce pours, but you can also split your ticket in half and get half pours, so you can diversify your life. Finally, that very same day, another conflicting event, but a fun one and a really quick one. LIC, IPA and LIC. Our friend Joshua M. Bernstein put out a book recently, Leap Guide to IPA, or the IPA, I forget the name of the exact wording of it. It's a book called Everything IPA. And in celebration of its launch, he's doing a hoppy bar crawl in Long Island City, co-organized by Robert Sherrill. They're stopping at LIC Beer Project, Big Alice. They're having a quick preview at Fifth Hammer. I'm going to host them for a second. And then going to Rockaway Brewing Company. And the IPA that they're having at Rockaway Brewing Company has been distilled by our friend Dave Krako from Arcane Distilling. And they're going to have a taste of it, the distillate of that beer, which should be pretty interesting. Go to joshuaandbernstein.com for more details.
And the title of his book is Complete IPA, The Guide to Your Favorite Craft Beer.
Thank you.
So I have one announcement. My cider workshop at Bitter and Esther's here in Brooklyn is this Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. You can sign up or find out more information, although the date is wrong. We moved it back a week for various reasons. If you go to bitterandesters.com, click on Classes Cider Workshop.
Oh, and I also have a workshop coming up tomorrow, Tuesday the 27th at 7 p.m. I found out the address. So it's at 637 Baltic Street. That's on Baltic Street between 4th and 5th Avenues in Brooklyn. I'll be teaching a kombucha workshop, complete with giving out SCOBY. So if you want a SCOBY or you want to learn how to make kombucha or how to troubleshoot, just check that out tomorrow night. And I think there's an event on Facebook. If you just search a kombucha workshop, Moisha House.
We'll put a link on that.
And or if you want a SCOBY and you missed it, the event somehow, just shoot us a message. I will definitely have a bunch left over.
Right on. This is a lot of events, and we are excited to get into our show. But one last thing before we actually do. Today we got an email from a listener, Jacob Leeser, and he has got a double batch of hibiscus wine finishing up. One hibiscus with honey, so mead, he guesses. Absolutely. The other has ginger and Ceylon with white sugar. His main question is whether we think colored bottles for protection is important or clear for presentation. Also wondering our thoughts on sweetening and carbonation, though he hasn't sampled it yet. Mary, being as these sound short and in your wheelhouse, I'm going to go right to you here.
Well, I think we can agree that
bottles.
Clear bottles are fine.
Yeah.
Although, whether you want to, what kind of bottles, plastic, glass, flip top, etc., is going to depend on your carbonation. So there's no, he didn't give us an ABV or original gravity or final gravity or anything. But if you're doing a true wine, so like more of a wine strength, I think it's going to depend on what you're looking for. If you're looking for something very dry and you let it, you know, finish out its gravity, then I would say that you could serve it still in, you know, a clear bottle. You don't have to worry about breakage because you're already at terminal gravity, as long as you know it's stable. The other thing you could do is if you're doing a shorter beverage, so a smaller beverage, a lower alcohol beverage, then what I like to do is go ahead and bottle it. I prefer plastic at this point. I use amber PET, but you could do it in soda bottles or any clear bottle. You could also use glass flip top that are rated for carbonated beverages. Not all glass flip tops are. I've had very bad experience with the square shaped.
And look out for the cheap ones from IKEA. Like they sound like they're discounts, but they'll explode.
Yeah. Although I've had good luck with those.
Really?
Yes.
You
but
had one
I've
very
heard bad
unlucky
stories about them too.
Yes.
You've had an unlucky situation with one though, too.
No, not with that. With a square bottle.
Where was the square bottle from?
Some store.
Some discount store.
Yeah.
Just look good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't buy at the dollar store.
Yes.
Get good ones.
Also, if you use a flip top bottle, I would always recommend putting a little bit in a plastic bottle, a small, you know, those like little teeny water bottles, because then you'll be able to gauge how much carbonation you're getting, because you'll be able to squeeze the plastic and feel how tense it is. And you'll know approximately, you know, when you need to toss it in the fridge. If you're going to do that and you haven't reached terminal gravity, then just, you know, put it in, make sure you keep it cool, and then, you know, drink it within a reasonable amount of time, because it will continue to ferment a bit in the fridge.
Or you could burp it as well.
That's true.
Before you get to the fridge.
Yep.
If you think you're overcarbonating.
Yep.
With the flip top.
The other thing I want to mention, and I won't go into too many details, but we received two books recently, and they are both, well, we've actually had them on the show before in one way or another, and we're definitely going to try to get them on for later in this season. So the first is The Homebrewer's Almanac. It's by America Josephson, Aaron Clyden, and Ryan Talkstein. I'm probably butchering your names, and I apologize, but they are from Scratch Brewing Company in Ava, Illinois, and this is it's a super cool book. It's basically a seasonal, well, it's the subtitle says it all, a seasonal guide to making your own beer from scratch. So it's broken out by seasons, beginning with winter, ending with fall. It's absolutely gorgeous. It has full color photographs, and they choose different things, everything from, let's see, sage to mint to sweet potatoes to oak. They tell you all about the plant itself, how to harvest it, brewing with it, and they also give a lot of substitutes in the recipe. And then they have at least one recipe for every one of these seasonal ingredients in a 5-gallon batch size. So I haven't been able to try one of the recipes yet since we've been out of town, but they look really, really good. The photos are beautiful. Like, it's definitely makes me want to get my brew pots out again now that it's cool enough. The other thing is we got the updated version of Wild Fermentation, the Flavor, Nutrition, and Craft of Live Culture Foods by Sander Elix Katt.
And the cover is even more eye-bending than the first one.
That is true. So the original Wild Fermentation came out in 2003. Mm-hmm. And that kind of, I mean, that was one of the first fermentation books to come out that really got people into it.
Yeah. I call Sander Katz the Scobie mother of fermentation.
Yes. But it was in black and white with drawings. The new version is 100 pages longer, and it is chock full of gorgeous photographs. I mean, photographs aren't always important, but I do think that they're very inspirational, and they give you a better idea of what you're looking for, and, you know, they're just, oh man, it's just beautiful. Anyway, so he has added more recipes, updated the recipes, pulled some out, and it's just, it's a really, really beautiful book. I have the old version, and even if we had not been sent the new version, I definitely would have bought it because it's just great. So I would highly recommend both of these books. They're available now from, you know, on the internet, or please ask your favorite bookstore to stock them. So that's, again, The Homebrewer's Almanac, and the second is the updated version of Wild Fermentation.
And Here we go. Welcome to the show.
Speaking of wild fermentation.
Yeah, speaking of wild fermentation and seasonal ferments.
And seasonal ferments and foragers.
You may remember from episode 158, Rob Handel is the bee's knees. Ladies and gentlemen, Rob Handel.
Hey, Rob, do you have...
Hi, how are you doing?
Hey!
Thanks for sitting through our announcements, Rob. Thanks for the patience.
Yeah.
No, not at all.
So last time we checked in with you, I think you were doing a lot of ferments, and now we've turned seasons. It's what's the temperatures up there? You guys are in the 70s or maybe lower right now.
Oh yeah, this morning early in the morning it was about 34.
Whoa.
Up here,
oh my
believe it or
God.
Not, and it climbed into the very low 70s over the course of the day. But last night we actually got our first official frost of the season.
Whoa.
Oh my God.
So yeah, we're moving into a different ferment. It's time for our different season. It's time for a seasonal fermented update from Rob. I have to ask you though, is the fish sauce still going?
The fish sauce is still going, yeah. I've tried it several times and it's definitely improving each time I try it. And I've had other people who were kind of morbidly fascinated with the concept of it also. And it's really good. It, you know, it, at the moment, I have it sitting in a glass jar. I had it in a bucket, and it's hard to see how it's separating. So I've moved it to a big glass vessel so that I can monitor the separation of the solid from the liquid. And it's almost at a point where I'm ready to decant the clear liquid off and leave the solids behind and then really be able to get a better idea of what it tastes like.
And so you'll keep the clear liquid and kind of let that further develop on its own?
Yeah, well, the clear is really the fish sauce itself.
Okay.
As far as Roman fish sauce goes, they would actually save the solids and do other things with them. And typically it was the peasants who would have easier access to the solids and that taste that's left, whereas the elite would be able to get the clear sauce. So up until now, it's been pretty cloudy when I've been sampling it, so I'm interested to see what the flavor difference is between the clear stuff and the cloudy stuff.
Ooh.
What do you do to get it clear? Is it just time and temperature?
Yeah, at the moment, I'm just letting it stratify. And what's interesting, and I'm not sure the science behind it, is that the clear layer is in the middle. And, you know, there's a layer of cloudy stuff above it and a layer of cloudy stuff below it. So clearly some of the cloudy stuff is more buoyant than others. So I'll probably just, you know, try to slide a tube down in there and siphon off from the middle and then run it through a filter.
Interesting.
Cool. Well, we look forward to hearing, touching back with you about the fish sauce.
And meanwhile, we've all been stalking you on Facebook and seeing all of your amazing mushroom forages. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the things you've been making with those?
Yeah, so, you know, mushroom season has been a little weird here because it's been really dry this year, but we've been getting these kind of big spurts where we'll finally get some rain and the forest will explode with mushrooms and then they'll all disappear again. During the last one, a few weeks ago, I found what is called a beefsteak mushroom, and they're called beefsteak mushrooms because they grow on the side of trees, and they're these kind of big, round, big, flat, oblong mushrooms that look like a chunk of steak or liver growing on the side of a tree. And they're actually, the flavor on them is nothing like you would associate with a typical mushroom. They have this really tart flavor to them, this tart, acidic flavor. And a lot of people will slice them really thin and eat them raw. And this one was a little older, and there was a little bit of bitterness in the background when I tried slicing them thin like that, just eating them as they were. And I found it kind of unpleasant to eat by itself, but I figured it would be a great addition to one of these foraged bruits that I've been doing. You know, so I happened to have some elderberry, I've been calling them elderberry scraps that I made syrup, so they were the skins and the seeds and whatever bits of pulp didn't get strained through the, you know, through the colander when I was making the syrup. So I had such a great success with this black cap bruit I made earlier in the summer that I decided to use some of those similar herbs like yarrow and nettle. And this one I added sassafras twig. Those are things that when you ferment them out, they give this kind of beer-like essence, even though there's no grain or malt or hops or anything like that in it. And I also added the dried beefsteak mushrooms and then the elderberry scraps. and I fermented it by back popping some of the black cap bruit that I had made earlier in the year. And I decided I would go with more of a ghost feel on that because of the tartness inherent in the mushroom. And I knew there was some lactobacilli in the black cap bruit. And just I just finished carbonating that the other day, and it's really tasty. It has this great kind of funky note from the elderberries, which can have a little bit of a kind of a currant, a black currant flavor to them. And the tartness and the salt, it all works really well together.
Awesome. Did you say the base beer for the black cap was a Gosa? No, the second one.
Sorry, what was that?
The base beer for the gruit on the black cap. Was that a Gosa?
No, that wasn't. I didn't use any salt in that one, and it did come out sour. That was completely a wild ferment. You know, I made my wort with all of the different herbs, and I cooled it overnight, and then I just added the black cat berries that I had picked. So it was just the yeast on the outside of the berries.
Very cool.
And that came out really nice. And that was a lot lighter, though. So that was a bit of a lighter, more floral, kind of Belgian sour style beer. And then I used that to inoculate the Gosa.
So I feel like we have to have a footnote about mushroom foraging, because I know somebody is going to email or tweet at us.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of experience foraging mushrooms, but obviously it's going to depend. There are some poisonous mushrooms out there. So I wouldn't recommend just people, you know, foraging mushrooms unless they're, you know, I know there are classes out there and some good guidebooks. I took mycology as, I don't remember if it's undergrad or grad school. So, you know, I learned identification, but I would, you know, recommend that you get some experience. Or you probably, did you go out with an experienced forager, or how did you learn about mushrooms?
A whole bunch of different sources. We have a guy up here who is fairly well heated in the mycology world, and I've gone out with him. I've asked him. He often stops by Heather Ridge, so I frequently will bring mushrooms there for him to double check for me.
Cool.
I've done a lot of reading. Yeah, if you're in the New York area, there is the New York Mycological Association, and that's a great resource. You can join and become a member, and they do different forays. And there's a man named Gary Linkoff who teaches mushroom classes, and he's based out of the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens, maybe.
Cool.
And you can go out with him, and he wrote one of the Audubon guides for mushroom hunting in North America, so he's a great resource.
Cool. I had some other thought on that, but now I don't know what it is.
We had just talked about mushrooms the other day, and there's one mushroom in particular that looks a lot like a very common mushroom in China.
It's a death cap mushroom.
It's a death cap mushroom.
Which is Amanita or something.
Yeah, that happens. It's actually, the statistic on that is that the most mushroom poisoning in the U.S. happens with Southeast Asian immigrants.
Yep.
And it's because there's a mushroom called the straw mushroom that is very common in Southeast Asia, and they all know how to pick it. But there's a poisonous lookalike in America, and immigrants aren't always aware that there is this lookalike. That's a lot of problems.
Yeah. So we're going to be right back. Rob is doing a lot more ferments and has had a lot of fermenting coming up. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more Ferments with Rob.
Are you an East Sider? We live on the east side of town. Our shipping container studios are at Roberta's in Bushwick, across the East River, separating New York City and Brooklyn. In all my recent travels, it seems like the east side of town is the cool side of town in cities across the country. East Nashville is full of musicians and weird bars. The up-and-coming neighborhood around 8th Street in D.C., on the east side, is overflowing with exciting food and nightlife. Nothing is more fitting than a cool, refreshing can of Austin East Ciders. That's East Cider with a C. As the name implies, it is cider, and it's handmade on, you guessed it, the east side of Austin, Texas, using bittersweet and bittersharp cider apples. Cider apples are full of tannins, adding astringency and complexity of flavor to every sip. Austin East Ciders uses a mixture of European and Pacific Northwest apples to achieve ultimate flavor. Austin East Ciders is available in a few different variations, including original flavor, Texas honey, and two new additions, hopped and pineapple. Here at Heritage Radio, we love Austin East Ciders with some ribs, pulled pork, and even pizza, especially Roberta's pizza. You can find out more at austineastciders.com, and remember to hashtag EastCiders to show your East Side pride. You can also find Austin East Ciders on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Welcome back to episode 177 of Foment About It on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We are on the phone with Rob Handel, the executive chef from Heatheridge Farm, the executive chef at Bee's Knees Cafe at the Heatheridge Farm. And we are talking all sorts of ferments. Rob is a constant inspiration. He does a lot of crazy, interesting things. He's a teacher, he's a blogger, he's a fermenter, and he's a forager. And currently, Rob, tell us about the wild grapes that are in season and what you're doing with them.
Yeah, so wild grapes are one of the things that are found almost everywhere in North America. They're so, ubiquitous. And often they're even found in urban areas. You know, you'll go through parts of town that don't have a lot of on. You'll see covering fences and that kind of thing. And most of them are incredibly sour. So they're not the kind of grapes that you want to just eat out of hand. They grow in these small clusters, and they're also really tiny. They're maybe about the size of a pencil eraser, each one. And there's a seed in there, and the skin is a little tough. So, you can't really make a pie with them or, a table grape, but they are a great intermediary in doing some culinary things. So one kind of non-fermentable culinary thing that's accessible for people is just making a jam or a deli with them. You know, you can simmer them in some water and strain out all of the pulp and the seeds, and then to make a deli that's actually pretty nice. And that works because you're adding so much sugar. So they are kind of dependent on having some sugar there to cut back on the tartness.
Right.
But along a similar line to that, they would be great to make a fermented soda with. You could take them, go through the same procedure of adding a little bit of water, simmering them, cooking them, and then straining that out, sweetening to taste, and then just letting it ferment for a day or two to carbonate it, or a few days to carbonate it, being careful to either burp or have appropriate bottles, as you were discussing earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You definitely don't want to have these explode. When I was about 12 years old, I tried making wine using these wild grapes, and nobody told me about airlocks or carbonation or any of this kind of thing. And my mom came home to the kitchen absolutely covered in this vibrant purple grape. So,
awesome.
Try making wine when you were 12.
They do tend to ferment pretty vigorously.
Did you claim dyslexia about the age,
this. 12, 21.
Sorry.
I was saying, did you claim dyslexia about trying to make alcohol at 12?
Well, at that point, I wasn't so much interested in drinking it. I was just interested in the concept of turning wild grapes into something that somebody could consume.
Yeah.
I love it. Yes.
Now, you mentioned that you just had your first frost upstate. Does that affect the vegetables or like the forages in any way?
Yeah, no, it really does. It does affect the grapes. For instance, a lot of the cool weather crops actually end up tasting a lot better after you get a frost. And part of that is the plant's defense mechanism against the freezing. So, what they do is they concentrate their sugars, and that acts as a bit of a natural antifreeze to buy them a few extra days when the frost starts hitting. So the wild grapes tend to get a little bit sweeter. I mean, they don't get too much sweeter after the frost, but a lot of other cool weather crops like Brussels sprouts, beets, carrots, cabbages, even squashes, they all tend to concentrate their sugars as the frost starts to hit. And they may be perfectly good all year long, but they're really a lot better after that first frost bump. So this week I'm excited to source more beets and carrots and parsnips from the local farms around here, because I know they'll be the best that we've had yet this year.
Cool. Now, are you planning on doing some krauts or other ferments with some of these things?
Yeah, I am. I've done this. I've done a really great kraut using beets and red cabbage and carrots. And one of the fun things about it is it comes out this really vibrant purple. And our brand colors at Heather Ridge are purple, so that's one reason I like doing it. But the flavor is really incredible. You know, people are used to using cabbage for kraut, but you can use pretty much any vegetable that you can shred up. You can add to your kraut, or you can substitute for the cabbage. So I don't have the recipe that I use on me, but the kraut that I've been making for fall has been red cabbage as a base, but I throw a bunch of beets in there. I grate up onions. You could also use leek. Leek get real good this time of year because the same thing happens regardless of frost. The carrots are extra sweet at this point. And then I add a couple of kind of nice fall spices like caraway, some pink peppercorn, which is something that a lot of people aren't so familiar with. And it's a really great kraut. It acts as a really great foil to things like smoked meats and different sausages, which might be kind of salty and fatty. The essence of kraut is really nice for cutting through that, and some of those spices are kind of add freshness to it.
That sounds really good. Also, I but those would make killer pickle. The brine would make killer picklebacks. <That's
right. laughs> We've been using homemade brine for picklebacks recently. Pretty delicious. With this frost, is that affecting the apples at all in any way? What are the apples like this year?
Well, the frost. Typically, the frost might affect the apples as far as making them a little sweeter. But this year is kind of a tricky year for apples. The winter was really up and down, and a lot of the fruit up here suffered. So we didn't have, we lost the early season crop of cherries. Some places did have kind of a later season dark cherry, but we didn't have any peaches or nectarines or plums. All of those got wiped out by different cycles in the weather, whether the frost or got too warm too early. And apples are kind of along the same line. I have an old apple orchard here at my house that's about 100 years old. And last year, I just picked barrels and barrels of apples. And this year, there's only a couple on each tree.
Wow.
So, apple situation is a little bit of a bummer, but we did have a great berry year. And, there's been other things that have done well as a trade-off.
Well, that's, I guess, a small consolation.
I'm going to have to make berry cider.
Yeah. So when going back to using brine for picklebacks, what else can you do with brine? Because that's one thing, there's always a lot of leftover brine, especially if you make pickles or something more solid, you have brine left over. So what do you do with your brine?
Yeah, well, there is a lot of brine because you have to make sure everything's covered. And usually that's a lot more brine than you really could possibly drink either doing picklebacks. And some people like to just drink the brine straight, which is kind of on the fence for me. But one thing that I've been doing with it that's been working out really well is I've been curing and brining meats with it. So you could do anything as simple as just a really quick brine on a pork roast, for instance. Leave it in for 8 hours or 12 hours to brine a pork roast to make it a little more juicy and provide some salinity and some of the acid in that brine. The lactic acid fermentation will help to tenderize the meat a bit. Or you can do a longer cure. I've been making Reuben at the cafe all summer where, we use the fermented sauerkraut and we've been making rye bread and we brine the pastrami, the cuts of brisket, or if people want it leaner, you can do like a top round, for instance. You can brine that and cure it in the brine from the pickles. So what I typically do is I will I'll put the piece of meat and the brine together in a vessel and weigh it and then add 0.25% of curing salt to that. And that's what gives it the red color and that's what gives it the cured pastrami flavor. And then I'll usually add another 1% salt because some of the salt gets used up from the cucumbers and some of the salt. So I replenish it with a little bit of salt and let that brine for, up to 2 weeks. And then you take it and smoke it, or you can just cook it and smoke it as pastrami. If you just simmer it, it's corned beef.
And you're brining that, or marinating brining that at room temperature or in the fridge?
Oh, no, in the fridge.
That's what I thought. Okay,
yeah.
Just making sure.
Yeah.
I think also...
Yeah, for those long-term cures and stuff, it's you always want to do that, you know, at below 40 degrees.
Cool. Mm-hmm. And that also would probably be a good for marinade for veggies as well. We did some portobello mushrooms on the grill over the weekend, and I bet that pickle brine would make a good marinade for portobello mushrooms or zucchini or squash or a lot of different kinds of veggies. And tempeh, probably, too.
But you wouldn't reuse
the brine.
Yeah,
it would. After. And you can do a marinade, or you can actually even use it in vinaigrette. You know, you can substitute some of the vinegar or all of the vinegar for the pickle brine. There are some Eastern European pickle soups where they use it as part of the broth in the soup.
Borscht.
There's a few of those in wild fermentation.
Yeah.
But you would never reuse any of the brine for the curing the meat. I mean, at that point, would you turn that into sauce and maybe reapply it to the meat?
No. Once you cure the meat in there, then I would just dump it down.
Discard it. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we're getting close to winter. Things are closing down. What are some foraging? How can we not miss the foraging season? What's up? And how much time do we have?
Well, as far as it goes up here, now that we're seeing some frost, it's really only a few more weeks. There are still, if you're looking for some of the herbs that you can apply to either gruets or these kind of wild-crafted beers. There's often late season nettles. You know, if you had a patch of nettles that had been mowed over throughout the summer, now that it's cool again, they're often starting to reemerge. There is still some yarrow out there, and that's a pretty common wild. Artemisia is still out in some, you know, to some degree. And sassafras, which I've actually been using the sassafras twig, the root is often what's used in something like root beer, but the twigs have really nice kind of citrusy notes to them.
Wow, that sounds really awesome.
I'm so sad not to have been up there yet. I really want to visit you, and I want to taste some of these liquids coming from some of these gruets. They sound delicious and awesome and inspiring for sure.
And are you planning an event, right? Or starting to?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm starting to. We're planning on doing something fermentation related over the winter at Heather Ridge. So, you know, we're up here in the Catskills. It's about 3 hours from New York. And I don't have a date set for it yet, but we're planning on doing a weekend intensive where we're going to try to cover a pretty broad spectrum of fermentable. We'll set up ferments, and I'll have some that have been set up early and completed so that we see the whole spectrum and talk about doing some of these things like the herbal gruet, where you know, you can gather those herbs in season and dry them and use them year round, that kind of thing.
Wow. Oh, we're going to be on the lookout for that.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of this knowledge and ideas and inspiration. And we look forward to checking in with you later on this year or early next year.
I vow to come visit within the next few months. Yeah. I'm going to see you at the Bee's Knees.
Yeah, let us know about when that that winter fermentation workshop is.
Yeah, we'll definitely help spread the word.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I'll be there.
Yeah.
All right, that's great. Thank you so much.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rob.
You're the best. Thank you so much.
All right.
Cheers from Medibot.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Wild stallion, hell bent to win, a battle with no winners, a war with no end.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.